ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
David Unipon, an esteemed figure in our history who left an indelible mark on the nation's cultural and scientific landscape. Renowned as an inventor, a writer, advocate for Indigenous rights, Unipon's contributions have been celebrated not only within the Indigenous communities across our country, but the legacy is quite extraordinary. Innovation, resilience, cultural pride, also a legacy that remains widely forgotten or perhaps even unknown. Joining us on Overnights this morning is writer and historian Nigel Carney to tell us all about it. G'day and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for showing an interest in the story. And that was a very succinct summary of the man.
Well, I'll put my hand up and say I didn't know about it. So let's start with you. How did you become aware of David's history and legacy?
Okay, I've been studying South Australian history for 20 years.
Yeah.
Therefore, it was on the radar. It would eventually come up. I took an interest in the Narrindjeri tribe, which occupies the Coorong district, Jervis Bay, around the southern peninsula of South Australia. And then the more I looked into the story, the more I became amazed by his background, his upbringing, and the history of the Point McClay mission, which is known as Raukan. So, and then by chance, one of the great nieces of David Unipon visited our town, Betty Summer, and she was gobsmacked that I had done so much research and was interested in the story. So then I had the opportunity on a couple of occasions to visit Raukan, and that really made all of the research that I had done come to life. And just through these visits, I was able to pick up little bits of extra information along the way. So it's an extraordinary history. So, and the history changed radically over the time that the mission was established. So the original mission was established by a group called the Friends of the Natives, Aboriginal Friends Association, which was a multi-denominational group led by George Taplin. And look, there's a lot of controversy about all sorts of Aboriginal history, but I think it would be fair to say that the group that set it up had all of the best intentions, and the actual survival of the Narrindjeri was on the line. They experienced smallpox outbreaks really 2 decades before the establishment of the mission. So the AFA established a community, they established farms, a schoolhouse, a church building and housing. And this was the environment that David Unipon grew up in. So added to this, he was in an extraordinary situation. His father, James, now you asked about the pronunciation. So the Unipon is it's a modernized version of the name. So his father, James Negatapony, you'd have to talk to a Narrindjeri person to look at the actual proper pronunciation of that. But his father was an initiated lawman. And so he taught David, he read the Bible, the King James Bible, to David from a very young age. And it was the viewpoint of James Unipon that there was great similarities really between religions across the world. And in terms of integration, the idea of joining into becoming involved with Christianity was not a bad idea. So James, his father, he became the first, I think it might have been 1865, the first ordained preacher, Aboriginal preacher. So there's another one for the books. And his mother was also, Nimbolda was also a significant person, and her father was a law person as well. So you could say he had particular advantages with his family setup. That compelled him. So one of the lessons that was repeated to David after the Bible studies was that in all his endeavors, he should avoid greed and avarice and seek to be on good terms with all men. So he had interesting that David was well versed in, you know, the Aboriginal tribal knowledge and the myths and legends But at the same time, he had the Christian insights as well.
Yeah.
So then, as he's growing up, one of the members of the Friends Association, important Adelaide business person, C.B. Young, he visits the Raukan community, the Point Maclay Mission, and he's highly impressed with the intelligence of the community down there and what they're achieving. So he takes David on as a servant, if you like, at his property.
Yeah.
So this is really David's first introduction into the Western world and, Western libraries and access to all of the resources that he's going to consume all of the great literature and poetry and science, and he's going to become a very fast learner. So now he's 12 at this point. So you can see he's really taking full advantage of his particular circumstances to get out into the world.
And access to education, obviously.
Absolutely. Self-educated.
Yeah. So what time frame are we talking about? When did he live?
Well, he was born in 1872.
Right.
And he died in 1967. So he lived to a ripe
he did.
Age.
Yeah.
And he was a prolific writer and a prolific inventor throughout his life. So an interesting famous event, or the most famous invention, was his reinvention of the shearing shear, utilizing his study of perpetual motion. He developed a reciprocating lateral motion shear, which was quite revolutionary. So that was the first patent in 1909. And that certainly got him excited. So from that point, he became quite passionate to continue exploring perpetual motion. And he was constantly seeking business partnerships with businessmen in Adelaide so that he could benefit from the commercialization. But the situation, of course, was that the process of converting a lodge patent into a completed commercial patent for an Aboriginal at that time is a non-legal entity, was massively complicated.
Look, give the listeners some perspective of how influential this man was. He has been referred to as Australia's Leonardo da Vinci. Writer, inventor, artist. Was he into art as well?
Well, he was a great lover of poetry.
Okay. Yep.
In terms of art, producing art, that hasn't entered into any of my research.
Yeah.
But one of the insights that Betty passed on to me when she visited the Flinders Ranges was she remembers him in the Raukan community, walking back from church, and he would always say hello to everyone. And it struck her that he had a very cultured, almost a Scottish accent. And that struck her. So this becomes important because between 1920 and 1925, he went on a tour, if you like, of the east coast of Australia, and he lived in Sydney, but he travelled around the regional towns north of Sydney and right up to Richmond River. And he would do lectures in town halls and churches, and word got around that the headlines of the times were the headlines of the times. Clever Aboriginal, Aboriginal genius, and so forth. So he was filling halls and doing lectures on Aboriginal myths and legends with this very distinctive and refined accent, and the reviews in the newspaper were just extraordinary. He made a huge impact as a person delivering lectures, and he was at this time still very passionate about attracting support for his latest perpetual motion invention, which he'd already patented by that time.
I'm speaking with writer and historian Nigel Carney about this extraordinary Australian, David Uniapon. So tell me, the $50 note thing, I can guarantee most Australians, I said to my producer, Al. I said, mate, I've hardly ever got a 50 in my wallet, so I can't even look. But how did that? How did he come to be on the $50 note?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
And that going back to the process of notes being issued and prepared is a long, drawn-out process.
My word.
Yeah. And this happens over a long period of time. I could speculate. I would imagine that by 1990, a decision would have been made, that the decision was made that he was going to be chosen to be on the note. And then a process of consultation begins, and then the design works begin.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was probably, okay, who do we choose? Academics and journalists have praised him over the decades. So it was just his time, more or less, I believe.
I'm willing to wager, Nigel, that Paul Keating might have had something to do with it. That was around his time, because just a little thought popped into my head. But yeah, you're right. I mean, journos and that knew about him. What an extraordinary fella. Nigel, what an extraordinary fella. And in a time when, you know, there was basically no recognition, it was years to come, of Indigenous people in Australia, when he was in his prime, which would have been, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s. So what an amazing fella.
That's right. And people need to realise as well that for an Aboriginal to travel outside of a community like the Rauquin community, that was like a complex situation. So what was issued was an exemption pass, and the exemption pass came with a whole bunch of complications. You had to get special permission to travel on Commonwealth railways. You effectively relinquished your Aboriginality by accepting the terms and conditions of the exemption card. So he was very brave and forthright, not only to be challenging existing notions of Newtonian science and having his say pretty staunchly on, you know, the Aboriginal rights questions, but he was doing this at a time when you simply, you know, an Aboriginal travelling around the country was just not a normal thing. He was a very, very brave person to be doing that. So I can only imagine the experiences he would have had along
too.
The way.
Me too. And must have played, Nigel, a very important role in promoting understanding and appreciation of Indigenous Australians and their culture.
Well, yes, he did. And it's interesting that he contributed to government inquiries, and he was a great letter writer, and his letter writing was very eloquent, like his talks. So he contributed to a very important Commonwealth inquiry into the condition of the Aboriginals, which was the Bleakley inquiry. And he was also in dialogue with the South Australian Aboriginal Protectorate Office. So what happened in, I don't know what the situation in the other states was, but in 1910, the Aboriginal Bill was passed. And this meant that the management, for want of a better word, of Aboriginal settlements was then transferred to the Aboriginal Protectorate Office. So this also meant that the role of the Aboriginal Friends Association was now going to disappear into the past. So he was there on the ground visiting and staying with his family, because his family lived at Rauquin. But an event happened in 1926, which highlights that he was widely respected through all of his sharing of information of the culture. But when it came to 1926 and the complications that were occurring with the management of the Rauquin Mission, he was actually arrested, and he was arrested and put in jail.
On what grounds?
Vagrancy. Now, you have to remember, he was an advocate for his people. So in terms of being able to represent grievances, and there were grievances in the 1920s on the mission.
Oh, my word.
He was one of the people there that not only had connections, you know, in government and the business world, but he was a great letter writer. So you could say that he was punished for being an activist. And when it became apparent that he might have been sharpening the pencil for the community representation, that was the result. Now, but you have to remember as well, If there is some audio, Betty Summer has some of the audio. I have some of the audio, and it actually quite insightful, because you can actually hear how passionate and how forceful he is, and yet he has a terrific sense of humour. So right. At the point that he was approached by the police officer at the Rowcan Mission, he was told that he was being arrested under the charge of vagrancy, and he pulls a £5 note out of his pocket and produces some of the writing that he's been working on and says, "That's impossible. I'm here visiting my family. I'm writing, and here's a £5 note." So he was very quick on his feet to defend himself. And yes, he was put in jail, and then word got around and he was released. But it kind of shows how, you know, the conditions on these communities.
Oh, absolutely it does. Yeah, absolutely it does. Did you say he passed away in 1967?
Yes.
Well, that's just an incredible coincidence, because if memory serves me, that was the referendum which was almost unanimously carried for the parliament to have them included in the census. So there's a bit of symmetry there with David.
That's a really good point. So that was, so Aboriginals came under the Flora and Fauna Act up until 1967. So that is, I hadn't actually picked up on that. But he went out on quite a high for the Aboriginal people.
Well, as you know, referendums don't get carried very often, but that one, it was, I think, over 80%. I think it might have been close to even 90% that was carried by the Holt government in 1967, the year he passed away. So that's, I suppose, a bit spooky in a way. So the legacy that he's left for Indigenous people, I'm gleaning from the conversation, was you must be immense.
I think he was a silent achiever. And I think over time, I'm planning to publish a detailed story about his life, and I've really just tipped the touched the surface with you, because it's such a big topic. There's another the characters that came into his life are larger than life itself. So also during this period of time in the early 1920s, he was approached by Angus and Robinson Publishers to produce chapters for a book.
Right.
So he was being paid to write these chapters, and he was doing this in between his inventing and his lectures, and he would return the chapters and then he would get paid. I think he was paid in total £130 for the work completed. So he was set.
A lot of money in those days, yeah.
Back then it was quite a lot of money, but so he was. It would have been very helpful for his inventions as well. So he was set in 1925. To be the first published Aboriginal author in Australia. Now, so this becomes an interesting story, because a very interesting character, William Ramsay Smith, who's very interested in Aboriginal culture and collecting Aboriginal bones and skulls, and has a very controversial history with regard to that. Now, he is aware, he's been approached by a London publisher, Harrop Publishing, and they're producing a series of books titled Myths and Legends. So they're Myths and Legends of Africa, Myths and Legends of South America.
Yeah.
And so they approach their colleague and say, "Well, what can you do for us?" And so now he's aware that David Unaipon is writing up these stories. So he goes back to them and says, "Oh, leave it with me. I'll see what I can do." So he actually approaches Angus and Robinson in a series of letters, and basically says, "Oh, look, you know, this fellow David, very talented, but actually, no, he's a bad egg." He describes him as a bad egg. Oh. So Ramsay Smith intervenes. David Unaipon is unaware of what this breakdown in communications represents. And in the meantime, quite legally, because David Unaipon hadn't set any contract in place, quite legally, the manuscript is handed over to Dr. William Ramsay Smith and is edited and illustrated.
Yeah.
And it's published. I think it might have been published in 1929, published as Myths and Legends of the Australian Aboriginal by William Ramsay Smith.
Oh, God. Stolen.
Oh, yeah. Stolen from...
Absolutely stolen.
Yeah, so these are some of the events that David encountered during his life.
Fascinating story. Wow.
Yeah, and that is a book. Again, you could ask people, or if people don't know who is on the $50 note, it's unlikely they will have read Myths and Legends. But the Myths and Legends goes into a lot of the important stories, and some of them are written from the perspective of a children's education book. A lot of the stories are of that level, relating the role of the animals and the birds. And some of the stories are more, the legend of Jabruki is a more powerful story that relates to the implications of law being broken in the community.
Mm.
So it's a fascinating book. And if that had have been attributed to him in 1820 and royalties and other book offers would have. He was halted in his tracks by William Ramsay Smith and Dangus and Robinson. So he was a. He just got back up and, you know, continued
kept going.
Working.
Yes, yeah, just kept going.
And kept going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nigel, it's just a fascinating story. And so it's David, it's UNAIPON, David Unipon. And just a marvelous Australian. And What a man in our history he was. And you're right. When the book that you're writing, I'd be fascinated to read it. When do you think we'll be able to see that?
I've got a feeling I've finished the writing of the book, and I'm actually editing at the moment.
Great.
It's a thrilling story.
In terms of what
happened to him in Sydney. You could look at his entire life as an activist, as a writer,
inventor,
as a member of the Ralcan community.
Yeah.
But to be quite honest, I'm drawing elements of the Narrangeri history and the community really into some events which happened in Sydney.
Mm.
And this is a shock. It's a fantastic story, but it's a shocking story.
Yeah.
But in the telling of the story and in the manner in which David navigates through life, it's an inspiring story. Because he took those principles from the Bible, and he took the lessons from his father, and he went out there advocating for his community. He did his best to contribute to science and technology, and he met so many obstacles along the way.
He would have.
But he had a very philosophical approach to life, which enabled him to keep going. So it's an inspiring story.
It sure is.
A great Australian inventor. Yeah.
Yeah, an absolutely amazing life. Well, I look forward to your book, and I thank you very much for spending so much time with us to talk about David Unipon, writer and historian Nigel Carney. Thanks very much, Nigel.
Thank you, Tim.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.